Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mark Crist to discuss the landmark research he first presented last year at ASCO that defined the incidence and type of tumor driver mutations in metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung.
So about 3 years ago, 14 hospitals across the U.S. had a kind of common vision, and that was this, that we knew from our research that a substantial proportion of lung cancers had as their driver for their cancer effects, whether their metastasizing ability, their persistence despite our treatments, that they had a certain driver mutation, and that these driver mutations are good targets for therapy. So our idea was a very simple one, that we would kind of change our little paradigm, that people at the time of diagnosis, we would biopsy their cancer, try to find these driver mutations, and where we had a specific treatment already available, in this case it was erlotinib for people with EGFR mutations, we would give that. For those driver mutations where we did not have a standard therapy, what we would do instead was to refer those patients for clinical trials.
Could you talk a little bit more about what exactly a driver mutation is and what you thought you were going to see before you even started this?
Well, there are many, many mutations in cancer. And I think many people saw that New England Journal of Medicine article about the number of mutations even within a given tumor tissue. But not every mutation is the critical instigator, maintainer of that cancer state. Some of them are critical. So, for example, in leukemia, many of them, you can find mutations, find all kinds of chromosomal abnormalities, but not all of them are absolutely critical to the life of that cancer. Some are, and in CML, the BCR-ABL gene and the protein from that. But when you find that, though, if you find the driver and you turn off its effect, the cancer dies. The cancer is dependent on that. You know, the term is addicted, so-called oncogene addicted. If they don't have it, they die. And we believe we could find those things in lung cancer. And that was kind of the driving force behind our project.
So, yeah, a lot of people have heard that term oncogene addiction. And before you started to look at these tissues, what was the thinking in terms of how frequent these driver mutations were?
Well, there were theoretically, we knew that they were pretty common. We knew that RAS mutations are present in a quarter of the adenocarcinomas, that EGFR mutations somewhere between 10 and 20%. But I think even we were astounded, as we showed at the ASCO meeting last year, that we found a driver mutation in 54% of the cases. So more than half of the cases had a driver mutation that with 2011 technology we could find reliably, and that we could have some sort of therapy target against the effects of that oncogene. So I think that was the biggest finding we had last year.
Now, you know, I've been asking investigators in a lot of other cancers, what about other cancers, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, et cetera? Is there something fundamentally different about the pathogenesis of, let's say, adenocarcinoma of the lung, where you would, smoking, whatever, that you would expect to see more than what you'd see, say, in breast cancer?
Well, the truth is there are a small number of driver mutations that have been identified in breast cancer. There are some, but it's a minority of the cases, not the majority that we have in lung cancer. Blessedly, in breast cancer, there are other very critical factors, the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, HER2 amplification, that also can lead to a sensitivity to a specific therapy. But these driver mutations are not common in breast cancer per se. They're also different from cancer to cancer. I think many people saw and were disappointed by the fact that a drug like memorafenib, very effective in BRAF mutant melanoma, was not particularly effective in BRAF mutant colon cancer. So the context of these mutations does determine their ability to be drivers of oncogenesis. So while the themes persist, there are differences from cancer to cancer. And we knew that already, too. I think a pathologist would tell you that when you look at an adenocarcinoma of the colon, it has a very distinctive appearance among all the adenocarcinomas of the colon and compared to other kinds of adenocarcinomas. Lung adenocarcinoma, to the contrary, has a very wide range of appearance, a wide range of clinical outcome, and indeed, as we've now learned in our little project, a wide range of driver mutations behind each of these different types of lung adenocarcinomas.
Maybe you can comment a little bit on the issue of EGFR mutations and TKIs or treatments, and particularly what's happened over the past year that you think oncologists in practice should know about that's most important.
I think the main change, and it's probably a little more than a year now, is the idea that it makes sense at the time of diagnosis to test a patient's tumor tissue for the presence or absence of an EGFR mutation. This old, you know, profiles, clinical data that would say that somebody would likely to be responsive to a TKI or not was really faulty. And the best example of that was the trial by Tony Mock in the New England Journal of Medicine. If patients had these characteristics that predicted sensitivity to a erlotinib or gefitinib, things like being a woman, being from Japan, never smoking, even when you had those characteristics, if you didn't have that mutation, there was a 1% chance that gefitinib would shrink your cancer. And that idea has changed how people are approaching patients at diagnosis, and as much as can be done, people are having a biopsy now at diagnosis to see if the EGFR mutation is present. If it is, you get treated with erlotinib. If not, you go on to get chemotherapy. Now that we have crizotinib in patients with ALK rearrangements, that's been added to the repertoire as well. So nowadays, at the time of diagnosis, tumors are tested both for EGFR mutations and for ALK rearrangements. If you find an EGFR mutation, you get erlotinib. If you find an ALK rearrangement, you get crizotinib. If you don't find either or you're unable to test for a mutation for whatever reason, you'd treat with chemotherapy. And these concepts have now been encoded, and these are the standards of care in the NCCN guidelines.
So which patients specifically, let's assume you have tissue, do you think should have testing for these mutations?
I think today, every patient should have testing. I would probably not recommend routine testing in the case of small cell lung cancer. I would also not recommend it routinely in squamous cell lung cancer, with a couple exceptions. If the diagnosis of squamous cell lung cancer is based on a small biopsy specimen, or if the patient is a never smoker, I think those patients should be tested as well.
So I got an email from an oncologist in practice, Dr. Paul Kaywin, and he is asking me about something called ROS1. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what that is? And he wants to know how he can get that test done.
Sure. Well, we talked a little bit before about the unbelievable advances in the, I'll call it the science of oncology. From last Thanksgiving till now, three new targets have been discovered just in these last few months. One of them is ROS, another fusion gene. One is RET, R-E-T, another rearrangement like the ALK. And the third one is additional mutations in the HER2 gene. There are mutations in lung cancer in the HER2 gene. And Heidi Grulich and her group in Boston have discovered additional mutations. These mutations are driver mutations, but what's very important about them is each of those has a treatment already available that can target the effects of that mutation. So with ROS, it's crizotinib. The kinase that's activated by the ROS fusion gene can be inactivated by crizotinib. For RET, it is drugs that block RET kinase. Vendetinib is an approved drug already, and there's other research drugs, cabozantinib as an example, that are available. And for the HER2 mutations, we have lapatinib, we have trastuzumab, as well as research drugs too. So how can these things be routinely tested for today? We're working that out right now. Again, this discovery is only months old, and I think to Dr. Kaywin, we'll be able to advise you how to get those tests done, hopefully in the next few months, but that's something being worked out. But this is literally just months old.
So one of the things that was very striking about the ROS1 report and the JCO is they actually put a case in there with scans where somebody responded to crizotinib. Have responses been seen with the other two mutations you talked about?
With the RET, not yet. There haven't been any cases reported. The demonstration of the genes that it is a driver mutation is found in lung cancer cases was first published on Thanksgiving. And there are clinical trials already now in the approval process. It's actually pretty darn fast from a discovery on Thanksgiving that we'll have trials approved within the next few weeks. I mean, just an amazing story, but there are no trials approved yet today. But again, RET inhibitors are here. I mean, they're in your pharmacy already with vandetanib.
How about HER2? Have any patients been treated?
Not to my knowledge on that as well. I mean, we are treating HER2 mutations, not in this extracellular domain, but in the kinase domain. Again, there's trastuzumab, olaparib available, and there are clinical trials now. I know the Lung Cancer Consortium, we're testing dacomitinib. Afatinib is another drug that could be used for that, and there's proposals to study that as well, and there's trials in Europe doing that.
What do we know about afatinib? What do we know about that right now and how it differs from erlotinib?
Well, there haven't been any head-to-head comparisons is the quick answer to that. Two clinical trials were published in Lancet Oncology, one giving afatinib to patients with EGFR mutations at the time of diagnosis and showing a picture very like erlotinib, lots of shrinkages, a very good time to disease progression. The second one was a trial in patients that had so-called acquired resistance. They had received EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors and their cancer grew at some point after an initial response. That trial showed improvement in rates of shrinkage and also improvement in progression-free survival. That trial also was started before we did routine mutation testing. Not every one of those patients in that trial had mutation testing, so the results are a little tough to sort out. But I think it's clear that afatinib has activity in those patients as well, at least in terms of shrinkage and prolonging progression-free survival. And there are more trials being done with afatinib around the world, and there's a trial analogous to the IPASS study where patients with mutations are randomized to receive afatinib or a standard chemotherapy, and we're hoping to get some results out shortly in that. The trial is finished, and we're waiting for reporting of results.
Maybe as long as we're talking about afatinib, you might want to comment on the trial that looked at afatinib in combination with cetuximab and what we know about cetuximab with, say, erlotinib.
Well, William Pao, my colleague and now the head of medical oncology at Vanderbilt, has been one of the early pioneers in looking at the treatment of tumors with EGFR mutations after they have developed acquired resistance to gefitinib or erlotinib. And what he saw in his animal models was that if you gave erlotinib, the tumors did not shrink. If you gave cetuximab, the tumors did not shrink. If you gave afatinib, the tumors did not shrink. If you gave erlotinib and cetuximab, the tumors did not shrink. However, if you gave afatinib and cetuximab, the tumors did shrink in his mice and in a subsequent clinical trial in patients. And there's a trial going on now in the United States and Europe testing that combination. So Dr. Pao is now probing as to why that has occurred. He's also shown that panitumumab with afatinib also has good results. And, you know, that idea is moving forward. These trials are being expanded right now. So that's been a very interesting observation. And Dr. Pao is trying to fill out the scientific underpinnings for that. There are many other drugs in trial now, too, in this acquired resistance space. Trials are looking at HER3 monoclonal antibodies. They're looking at other EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. They're looking at adding in MET inhibitors, many different strategies to try to deal with that growing problem of acquired resistance.
So what do we know about these patients? I know your group has published on, I guess, the biology of progression or these situations where you have a patient who has an EGFR mutation, they have a good response, and then they progress. What do we know about the sensitivity of those cells at that point in time? And what about the idea of continuing erlotinib even in the face of progression?
You know, what I learned in oncology school has really been changed by the use of these targeted therapies in the oncogene-addicted cases. I think the first thing, I mean, I was always taught that the minute you diagnose progression, you stop the therapy and go to a new therapy. And that is clearly not the case with EGFR TKIs in patients that have EGFR mutant lung cancer. Professor Mok from Hong Kong gave me a beautiful set of slides. It was a patient that had a nice tumor shrinkage. 2 or 3 years later, the tumor, which had shrunken to 1 centimeter, was now 1.3 centimeters. So by RECIST criteria, the old RECIST criteria, that patient had progression. But that's all that patient had. And what Dr. Mock did, he just kept that patient on erlotinib, and he showed the slide 2 or 3 years later where that tumor now was 1.6 or 1.7 centimeters, and nothing else ever happened. So that's the first scenario, that people have a very small growth, just barely within the range of a CAT scan to detect it. And those people, the best choice is to put them on therapy. I mean, just think about it. Had you stopped that therapy, given cytotoxic chemotherapy, I put it to you, it would likely not have made that patient's life better. The second scenario, and this is an emerging one, is where people have an isolated site of metastasis, that multiple sites of cancer controlled and isolated metastasis with growth. And sometimes that can be a brain metastasis. Sometimes that could be one spot in the lung. Even in the face of progression, treating that one spot and the rest of the disease stays in control. So what we generally do is we stop the erlotinib, we treat that isolated metastasis, and then start patients back on the erlotinib. And there's some data from our institution that patients like that then go on for 1 to 2 more years of good control treating a solitary site of metastasis, which is obviously not the standard of care. And for patients that have symptomatic metastasis, multiple sites of metastasis, what we have also seen is that stopping the erlotinib will accelerate the growth of their cancer. We reported some data at the World Lung Cancer, has now been reported by my colleague Jamie Chaft, that when we're doing clinical trials and we had to have a washout period, and when we stopped gefitinib or erlotinib, a quarter of our patients who had been slowly progressing with their cancer suddenly ended up in the hospital or succumbed. So to me, that's a potent lesson about how a great majority of the cancer cells in those tumors remain sensitive to gefitinib or erlotinib. So it's important to keep suppressing those, or at least give another drug that could suppress the growth of EGFR-sensitive cells. You know, by the way, tumors that become resistant, they are still totally dependent on oncogenic signaling through EGFR. It's just that the drugs are no longer affected. It's not that that signaling pathway is negated. It can be bypassed. The blockade can be bypassed, but the dependence on that signaling goes on. So it's important to continue EGFR blockade, and then we generally add a cytotoxic chemotherapy to that.
I was just thinking about this oncologist who asked this question, just to finish out on that. So if you have a patient with metastatic disease who's a non-smoker, for example, who tests negative for ALK and EGFR, would you want to see this patient somehow find a way to get a ROS test, or is it too early?
I would like to see a patient have that, but you know, the actual testing for that is not worked out. Again, this is a discovery and really a few months old. There are clinical trials for this. There's a national trial for, you know, crizotinib. The original phase 1 of crizotinib is still open and now allows patients with MET amplification and also with ROS fusions on that trial. And that trial is available across the United States. That's probably the best way to approach that right now. But I would predict in a few years, multiplex testing, in addition to the current 10 driver mutations we look for, is going to include ROS, is going to include RET, R-E-T, and is going to include other mutations in HER2.
So let's talk a little bit about your cases, and maybe we can begin with your 52-year-old woman.
So the case I'm describing, and again, this case is an amalgam of many people, is a woman born in Seoul who was a never smoker. So she proverbially fit the profile for an EGFR sensitivity mutation. She was healthy, and she clearly had metastatic disease at the time of diagnosis. And in this case, she had multiple lung lesions and rib lesions. She was fit for chemotherapy. We did a biopsy and found adenocarcinoma. And we had submitted her material for a mutation analysis, both for EGFR and ALK. However, her bone pain was severe. We tried to palliate it with Percocet, and it was not successful. We tried to add in a long-acting analgesic. We used a fentanyl patch. It made her terribly nauseated, made her dizzy, actually required a visit to the emergency room because we were so dizzy, and we still could not control her pain. So the case here is, what do you do with somebody that has a possibility for an EGFR mutation or ALK rearrangement, but really can't wait till the test results come back?
If I were to ask you, what's the chance that she is going to have an ALK or EGFR mutation, what number would you throw out?
The numbers would say, in a never smoker, probably about 50-50 that she would have one of those things. But please remember the message of IPASS. If she doesn't have a mutation, and that was an EGFR mutation, her chance of having a tumor shrinkage from erlotinib is 1% unity. So that's not a very good number. And it showed in that same trial that if you gave that same person chemotherapy, she had a 25% chance of response.
Now, if somehow you knew at the point that you were evaluating her that in fact she did have an EGFR mutation, what would you have done?
I would have definitely treated her with, in this case, erlotinib, the only agent I have to do that. But I didn't know in this person, and I had to make that decision before that mutation result came back.
Just to clarify, though, when you say you would have used, let's say, erlotinib, what about the speed of response in a patient with EGFR mutation, EGFR TKI versus chemo?
Yeah, the speed of response actually to both agents when they work is extraordinary. I've seen over the decades with chemotherapy, the patients that are having good regressions from chemotherapy, that response happens in a matter of days. And I think the same is true for erlotinib as well. I don't think one therapy is better than the other. I think there's a higher chance, particularly in a mutated patient, of response with erlotinib. But the rapidity and the depth of the response can happen either with chemotherapy, if they're sensitive to chemotherapy, or with erlotinib, if they're sensitive to erlotinib.
So you were concerned because she was so ill and feeling so badly that you didn't want to take a chance on giving her an EGFR TKI up front?
Well, again, I'd be giving her a drug with toxicity and a 1% chance of benefit, whereas I could give her chemotherapy. Toxicity, yes, but she would have a 25% chance of benefit there. If she had a mutation, and I just didn't know, the chance of response with chemotherapy is 50%. So in this person, I would generally recommend giving chemotherapy. And that's exactly what her oncologist did here.
And what about radiation therapy to the sites of pain?
The wonderful thing about radiation, it works almost uniformly in the lesion that's radiated. This lady had multiple lesions in the lung, multiple lesions in the bone, and it was hard to say that there was one lesion that was a critical one. So to spend the time to plan the radiation, deliver the radiation, while her other cancer is symptomatic and growing, just didn't make sense to me. She needed a systemic therapy, and I thought systemic therapy was the best, you know, way to move forward here.
So what specific systemic therapy did she receive?
My reading of the literature says that in a patient with an adenocarcinoma that is fit for cisplatin and fit for bevacizumab in terms of hearing loss, hemoptysis, they should receive the three-drug combination of pemetrexed, cisplatin, and bevacizumab. And that's what I recommended for this patient. And her physician recommended chemotherapy like this as well.
And what happened?
Well, her pain got better in a matter of days. And what happened next in this case, though, was something unusual. And that is, I didn't get into how her diagnosis was made. Her pulmonologist made that diagnosis. And the pulmonologist, being very savvy, sent the tumor tissue off for EGFR and ALK mutation testing. The oncologist moved forward, as I said. And as it turned out, a couple weeks after this good result happened, the oncologist finally learned that she indeed had a mutation in EGFR. She had an insertion in exon 20.
And just before you continue on with this case, I meant to ask you before, I'm just kind of curious, in terms of management of side effects with EGFR TKIs, you have Dr. Mario Locutor there now at Memorial. And I'm curious whether, I'm just going to ask you a couple of just general supportive care questions in general. Anything that you've learned in terms of the dermatologic toxicity of EGFR TKIs that you might want to share?
Sure. Well, again, I've been extremely fortunate to have Dr. Locutor. He has really dedicated himself to providing care and researching the optimal treatment of EGFR TKI dermatologic side effects, and not just the rashes, but also the skin dryness, the fingertip cracking, pruritus, you know, all these things he has taken a career interest in. And it's just a great resource for me that when I have a patient that is faced with these side effects, to be able to send them to him. I guess my message is you need to be, let's say you're doing a bone marrow transplant on somebody, you have a whole repertoire of things that you would add to ameliorate toxicity. And I think Dr. Locutor approaches his patients the same way, using emollients, using topical corticosteroids, using antibiotics to treat secondary infections. He uses all those things to try to minimize the side effects of therapy. And I think that's my first message I've learned from him, is use all the tools you have. The second thing I've learned as an oncologist, though, is that you can use a much lower dosage of the TKI and yet have a good result. There's a paper from a colleague, Dan Costa, from Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, reporting a series of patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer treated with 25 milligrams of erlotinib, 1/6 the dose. There's a large literature in the basic science field that the mutated kinases are much more sensitive to the effects of tyrosine kinase inhibitors like erlotinib or gefitinib. So you can often use a lower dose. What I often do for people that have severe toxicity is I stop the drug until the toxicity resolves or gets to a very tolerable level, and I start back at a lower dose and try to titrate up. I routinely, by the way, start erlotinib at 100 milligrams. When you look at all the people that get erlotinib, that's probably the dose that the majority of people tolerate. You can go up if you have it well tolerated. You can go down if even that dose is tolerated, and I urge you to do that strategy.
So this lady actually had a response and was improving after getting a couple cycles of chemo Bev. What was the thinking once it was discovered she had an EGFR mutation, and what were the options?
Well, here are the options for this patient. One would be to switch to erlotinib. Another would be to continue the current chemotherapy and then go on to maintenance therapy. The third would be to add erlotinib now and then to do an erlotinib maintenance. And the last would be to finish the chemotherapy and add erlotinib maintenance as well.
How is she doing on the chemotherapy?
Well, as I said, she went back to work. She was able to attend her school board meetings at night, and she was elected head of the PTA. So she was doing really well.
Any bevacizumab issues?
No bevacizumab issues.
So what actually was done?
Well, again, this case is an amalgam of cases. And what the oncologist who originally was treating this patient did was they got back that result that she had an exon 20 insertion. And the oncologist interpreted that as saying she had an EGFR mutation. The oncologist felt that that would be a better way to go and treat the patient because of the lower potential for side effects, and that oncologist stopped the chemotherapy.
What would you have done?
Well, not all EGFR mutations are sensitizing, and that's one of the messages I'd like to get out. Generally, again, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but things in exon 20 are not sensitizing. That's where the T790M resistance mutation lives, and insertions in exon 20 are not sensitizing. Again, this patient, even when you started the erlotinib, went on to have a response, but that response was a lingering response to that initial chemotherapy, not to the erlotinib. So the right answer for this patient is to continue the chemotherapy, and I would urge to then do maintenance chemotherapy with the best drugs we have, and that would be bevacizumab and pemetrexed. When you look at the data on maintenance therapy, comparing the standard chemotherapy drugs to erlotinib, numerically, the improvements in PFS and overall survival are better with chemotherapy than erlotinib for patients that do not have sensitizing EGFR mutations. So what I would do for this person would be to continue chemotherapy, and when the initial cycles of chemotherapy were completed, to go on to maintenance chemotherapy with both bevacizumab and pemetrexed, and not to do any switching to erlotinib.
So I'd like to finish out talking a little bit about squamous cell and your case, and also some of the work that you all have done on squamous cell. But just one final question, getting back to adenocarcinoma. Any comments on MET and MET as a target, both using antibodies like the MET-MAB study and agent, as well as TKIs like ARC-197?
So MET is a new target. There is some preliminary data that there are PFS improvements with ARQ-197 and also with MetMab, and further clinical trials are going on to see if indeed those improvements seen in small populations studied so far turn out to be important benefits in the long term. There's other evidences of MET dependence. in those cases, and there have been a few of them on the crizotinib trials with MET amplification, amplification of the MET gene, then those patients have dramatic, I'll call them gefitinib or crizotinib type responses. So we in the Lung Cancer Consortium are looking for those cases with MET amplification, also with high polysomy, degrees of increases in copy number of the MET gene that do not meet the criteria for amplification or low-level amplification, and we are giving those patients crizotinib. So that's an emerging field. MET may also have a role in that acquired resistance setting as well, but I think the next few years are going to sort out what's the best approach to targeting MET. I'm slightly disconcerted to know that the MET-MAB does not produce those dramatic responses, even in those patients that have MET amplification. But time will tell if we're going to have other benefits to these patients. But clearly, crizotinib is an effective drug. Please remember, crizotinib was originally developed to inhibit MET, not to inhibit ALK, or now we know ROS as well.
Okay, let's talk about your second case, the 68-year-old man.
Yeah, so the second case is another one that I think folks have seen. It's a person this time, a smoker, quit, as most of our patients have now, 68-year-old, had a cough, no past medical history, chest x-ray revealed a lung mass and bilateral adrenal lesions, exam was normal, patient was still working, and we did a core needle biopsy of the adrenal lesion, and it was squamous cell cancer. And we had a lot of additional cores for more testing, and they're available for testing. So what are the standards of care for squamous cancer? First off, let's talk about who you would test for mutational testing. I think today, if you had a very tiny specimen and you were unsure that this was squamous or not because of the variability that can happen when a small specimen is examined, or the patient was a never smoker, I do think it would make some sense because of the possibility that those tumors were really an adenocarcinoma in disguise. I would urge testing for EGFR and ALK. If you go to the current NCCN guidelines, it doesn't say you should never test squamous. It says you shouldn't do it routinely. And the two criteria I would use today to do the standard EGFR and ALK testing for squamous cancer would be a tiny biopsy specimen and a never smoker, where you wouldn't suspect a smoking-related cancer like a squamous cell. We've done some work that will be presented at ASCO this year. And also when sequencing has been done of squamous cancers. And what we have found is we have roughly the same proportion of driver molecular lesions, we'll call them, in squamous cell as we do in adenocarcinomas. However, the specific mutations we find in drivers are different. We find amplification of the FGFR1 gene. There are some mutations in the FGFR2 gene. There is loss of P10. There are PI3 kinase mutations. There are also mutations in another gene, DDR1. When you add all these up, it again comes up to about 55%. So I think what you're going to see in the next year or two is we're going to have a testing panel for squamous cancer that will be different from adenocarcinoma. That said, because of advances in technology and analysis, it's actually going to become easier to test for every mutation that is felt to be relevant to most human cancers, and it's somewhere between 200 and 300 mutations. So we can now do in a fairly economical and quickly performed test, looking for all the mutations in every cancer. And what we're going to, I think, see in the next few years is we're going to be testing for squamous cell cancers as well. The treatments directed at those targets now are investigational. There are no available drugs against FGFR1. There are obviously drugs in study. FGFR1, DDR2, dasatinib actually is a drug there. So that drug would be available if you found somebody with a DDR2 mutation. But for P10 loss or PI3K mutation, again, you're going to be looking at an investigational drug.
I guess from my naive ears, when I hear PI3 kinase, I sort of think about mTOR inhibitors. Is that a connection?
It is a connection, and clearly mTOR agents are part of that pathway. I think what we found in patients where we've treated with mTOR inhibitors to date, that except for very special situations, and KRAS mutant lung cancers may be one of those situations, they in and of themselves are not of sufficient activity to substantially affect the natural history. There are trials right now using mTOR inhibitors with HSP90 inhibitors to attack KRAS mutant cancers. We've seen some responses with very certain kinds of RAS mutations, and there are a number of mTOR inhibitors being tested specifically for RAS mutant tumors. But as a general treatment, I think as a single agent, they have limited effectiveness. But I think as we genotype more cancers and do more extensive genotyping, we were likely to find some that will have some benefit from mTOR inhibitors. And that's a nice thing because we have them available already.
And I guess, you know, this kind of information on squamous cell is encouraging. People are looking for something different on squamous cell. You know, I see your paper in Clinical Cancer Research, I guess just from February. One of the things I was noticing about that series, kind of getting back to what you were saying before, is a series of patients with squamous cell, and yet you had a few people in here who were never smokers.
We did, and it does happen. And to me, we've learned, though, you know, we got into this project because of reports experienced by ourselves finding EGFR mutations and RAS mutations, for example, in squamous cell cancers. But what we found is when we got more tissue or looked at more sections of the tissues that were initially reviewed, there generally were some foci of adenocarcinoma. So the smaller the specimen, the more we need to be an open mind that some of the driving mutations for adenocarcinoma may be found there. The other thing is that there are immunohistochemistry tests that can point your way toward and away from squamous cancer. TTF1, thyroid transcription factor 1, is not seen in squamous cancer. And another protein, P63, is seen in squamous cancer. So you now have an immunohistochemical test that can help uncover some unsuspected adenocarcinomas doing a TTF1. And we urge in those cases to make that largely a part of care, that the immunohistochemistry test can help strengthen and support the diagnosis made on morphology alone. And I think you're going to see more and more pathology departments adding these standard tests to the armamentarium when there is anything but very obvious and unequivocal squamous cancer.
How do you approach patients with so-called mixed adenosquamous, or do you think that exists?
No, it does exist, and generally we treat them as an adenocarcinoma. And those are the ones where we have often found mutations like those seen in adenocarcinoma, EGFR mutations and KRAS mutations. So I would test those cases, and I would look for driver mutations that could help you direct therapy, particularly EGFR.
Anything happening in terms of driver mutations or targeted therapy in terms of small cell?
Small cell is slowly catching up to squamous, which is slowly catching up to adenocarcinoma. As you know, there are many more challenges in getting sufficient tissue. Very few patients with small cell lung cancer have surgeries. Up until recent months, the vast majority of cases of small cell lung cancer have been diagnosed with cytology and small biopsies. So we've had some difficulties doing more extensive genotyping. Also, the nature of the disease, because of its faster pace, there's less time to do additional biopsies, less time to wait for biopsy results come back, and people generally quickly go to treatment. That is changing now, though. What we have seen, particularly in the last year or so, is that whenever lung cancer is suspected, whoever is doing that initial biopsy, be it a surgeon, interventional radiologist, or a pulmonologist, they know that mutational testing is going to be necessary and that at the time of diagnosis, additional tissue is being taken now to permit mutational testing. Now, some of those cases are going to turn out to be small cell lung cancer, so we are going to have these tissues available. And we're just at the start of a prospective program like we have with adenocarcinoma and squamous to start mutational testing in small cell. But it's likely there, too, that the mutations and molecular events that are important to the growth and maintenance of small cell are likely going to be different than adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. So that's a work in progress, and I think you're going to see that accelerate very quickly in the next year or so.
So two final things I want to ask you about, a couple of papers that your group has done. First, a paper in cancer chemotherapy pharmacology, and I think a journal a lot of people don't read, about a phase two study of weekly albumin-bound paclitaxel. What you reported there, and just whether you have any thoughts about nab-paclitaxel in general in terms of where it might be heading or not heading in lung cancer.
Yeah. Well, I think there are some distinct advantages to that agent, and the biggest one is that you do not have to administer it with dexamethasone, which is a real hardship for many patients, particularly brittle diabetics, and also for people that often find themselves very uncomfortable when they take the high-dose steroids necessary to safely administer paclitaxel and docetaxel. The second group that it's tremendously helpful for are patients that have hypersensitivity reactions to either paclitaxel or docetaxel. So the NCCN guideline permit you to recommend albumin-bound paclitaxel for patients who have intolerance to dexamethasone or have had hypersensitivity reactions. So our standard of management in our department is that any hypersensitivity reaction, the paclitaxel or docetaxel is discontinued. And per the NCCN guidelines, we substitute albumin-bound paclitaxel. Whether it's better, I don't know. There's some benefits in terms of response rate, not benefits in survival. Where that's going to lead, I don't know. The other point in that paper, and I know a lot of people don't want to hear this, but it's true. We've done a couple of trials led by Nair Rizvi at Sloan Kettering, and we found albumin-bound paclitaxel to be a very reasonable drug, every bit as good as either paclitaxel or docetaxel with those other advantages I mentioned. But we also found that when you give a longer infusion, a two-hour infusion, that the degree of neuropathy is diminished. And we did a cohort of patients to try to prove that point, and indeed that's what we saw. An unexpected finding was that when we gave albumin-bound paclitaxel over 2 hours, the degree of neutropenia went down as well.
That is interesting.
So nobody wants to hear this because they do not want people in the chair any longer. But frankly, if by extra hour or so in the chair, you can cut down on the neutropenia, which is really the life-threatening side effect of this class of agents, and if you can cut down on the neuropathy, which is for most people the dose-limiting effect of these agents, it's pretty amazing. And I have to say, I've had people managed on this drug for literally years with no neuropathy. And again, that's a preliminary trial. It's not a randomized trial. But the data there to us was pretty compelling that the two-hour infusion is better. And that's how we routinely give albumin-bound paclitaxel when we do.
So final question concerning another paper report from your group. It was actually a poster at ASCO last year, but I like the title. I'd like to know the bottom line of the answer. Can we really treat patients older than age 70 with a chemotherapy doublet for non-small cell?
Yeah, that's a paper from Dr. Zauderer. And it's sort of a tough story, and unfortunately, I don't have the answer to this one. I think we've all seen the literature that giving a doublet to older adults is better in terms of response, in terms of survival. But equally as important and equally as true, the toxicity is always a bit more. It's not necessarily prohibitively more, but it clearly is more. Dr. Zauderer tried to use various characteristics that were felt to predict toxicity of the standard chemotherapy drugs in elderly patients. And she used some various scales of grading functional status of elderly. And the truth was, nothing really popped out to permit you to find those elderly that do well and those that weren't. I mean, the interesting thing is, a third of the elderly patients had no serious toxicities of the drug, and another third had serious toxicities and were hospitalized for them. And we could not find a way to tell who those one-thirds and one-thirds were. Others were in the middle. So that remains an area of interest and investigation, but sadly, I don't have a way to cleverly find out which elderly patients are going to have serious toxicities of their standard chemotherapy drugs.